Our text this morning is a bridge. And so in some ways, it ties back with Lazarus from last week. And it's a text that documents the response to Lazarus's raising. But in other ways, this text bridges all the way to the end of John, because the decisions of the religious leaders here will take us all the way to the cross, right at the end. Now, it is a bridge, but that doesn't mean it's a placeholder. So it's not actually just a necessary evil to get us from one important place to another. Actually, I think this text is a bit like driving over the Alex Fraser Bridge today. So if you drove over to that bridge today, you would get to the top, and if you're like me, you would have to be very careful not to crash into anything, because you'd be looking around at all the vistas that you can see from up there on the bridge. And I think that bridge texts in John do that in general. They're a moment for us to kind of catch the scenery, and we can use a text like this to see how John fits together all of the different kind of disparate pieces into one unifying purpose in the Gospel of John. And so with that in mind, the way that we're going to approach this text today is to look at some of the wider themes that run through the Gospel of John. And I think the outline is in your insert, in your bulletin, if you have an insert in there. And so the themes are very simple. They're just kind of these three contrasting themes that run throughout the book. Belief and unbelief, life and death, wilderness and Jerusalem. So let's have a look at belief and unbelief. If you're open to John 11, this is the first thing you see in verses 45 and 46. Now remember, this is the immediate response of the witnesses who saw Jesus raise four-day dead Lazarus from the dead. And the immediate response is two things, belief and unbelief. So if you read there with me, it says, many of the Jews, therefore, who had come with Mary and had seen what he did, believed in him. But some of them went to the Pharisees and told them what Jesus had done. Every time that Jesus does something significant in John, this division appears in the text. Many believe and many reject. Or in this case, many run to tell the Pharisees what happened so they can do something about Jesus. It's as if Jesus' words and his works are like a plow, and they're kind of cutting a furrow in the ground, and nothing can stay at the point of that furrow. Either it's going to be cast to one side in belief or cast to the other side in unbelief. The crowds are going to be thrown to one side or the other. This phrase that's here, many believed in him, it occurs eight times until chapter 12. And every time it occurs, every time many people believe in Jesus, there's an equal opposite reaction of resistance, anger, and hostility, especially from the Pharisees and the other religious leaders. And so we see in this gospel that Jesus is like a fault line running through Israel. Now, nobody is more aware of this tension than the leadership, who are trying to hold everything together. And we see that in verse 47. The chief priests and the Pharisees gathered the council and said, "What are we to do? For this man performs many signs. If we let him go on like this, everyone will believe in him, and the Romans will come and take away both our place and our nation." So here's the threat that the Jewish leaders see. Popular uprising. And then the inevitable Roman reprisal that would come after a popular uprising. These leaders actually find themselves in a pretty tricky position because they have delegated power. Rome has given them a little bit of controlled power to run the temple in Jerusalem and keep the peace. But their power in that sphere is contingent on being able to keep the people in check. And so if there is an uprising or some sort of really significant popular movement behind a Messiah, and it starts to get a little bit out of control, these leaders know that Rome is going to come in and just stamp it out. And they know the consequence is that Rome is going to take away our place, that is the temple, and their nation, that is their way of life. It's interesting, isn't it, that what the enemies of Jesus fear the most is the stripping of their political power and their religious place. It's interesting because they're much more scared of that than they are of something that's quite a bit more serious, which is that they might actually be opposing the Christ that was sent by God. I think it's striking the way that power and position influence people's willingness to believe in Jesus. It seems like for the leaders, the status quo is just a little bit too good to let Jesus keep messing things up. And actually, that kind of tension is also present throughout John. So you may remember from chapter 8, there was this really exciting or seemingly exciting conversion of a group of Jews. It says, as he was saying these things, many believed in him. And then it goes on and says, and he was talking to the Jews that believed in him. And it goes on and he's teaching all of these new converts. And then he starts to talk about his priority over Abraham. And all of a sudden, their kind of ethnic and social identity is challenged by Jesus. And just instantly they turn on him. And so 29 verses later, after all these people believing in him, it says they picked up stones to throw at him, but Jesus hid himself. In the next chapter, we get this dynamic again, and it speaks of how the people in large end up denying Jesus and turning against him. But we also get this really interesting caveat. It says, many even of the authorities believed in him, but for fear of the Pharisees, they did not confess it, so that they would not be put out of the synagogue. We see this dynamic as well in the brave blind man, right, in chapter 9, who is cast from the synagogue, but then there's his parents, on the other hand, who will do and say anything not to be. The kind of quality of belief is a really interesting question in the Gospel of John. And as we get more and more towards the end, we'll see that the many who believe in John are actually really struggling to prioritize belief over the status quo. And so whenever their belief in Jesus gets kind of personally challenging, all of a sudden it's replaced by unbelief. And the ultimate expression of this is Palm Sunday that we're coming up to, when the believing crowds shout Hosanna one day and crucify him the next. The powers that be, whether the religious leaders or Romans, are more compelling than what could be in Jesus and his grassroots movement. And so it becomes clear in John that one of the results of true faith or belief is a reordering of political commitments. We have to take our commitments to self and family and synagogue and Caesar and turn them over to Jesus as king. And John is very clear that that kind of belief in Jesus is totalizing and costly. It's interesting for us, I think, the temptation to unbelief comes from clinging to our own comfort and power, the way these religious leaders did. In chapter 20, John tells us that these things, that is, this whole entire book, was written so that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that by believing, you may have life in his name. And so all of these vignettes throughout the entire gospel, talking about belief and unbelief, are here to help us examine our own relationship with Jesus. And here in particular, we're challenged with the relationship of the various powers in our life and how they affect our belief. And so, to put it as a question, is our acceptance of the status quo, the positions of power that we inhabit, the comforts that we rely on, are those causing us, in the end, to embrace a form of unbelief? Are they taking precedence over the things that Jesus calls us to? And the question really is, have we sold out this man who is bread and water, shepherd and life, in the fear that his rule may take away our nation and place, whatever that is for us? As we move on, we'll see that's exactly what the leaders do. And as we continue in the gospel, we see that's exactly what everybody does, the entire nation. But that takes us to our second point, where we talk about life and death. So this takes us back to last week. Last week, we heard about Jesus raising 4-day dead Lazarus back to life. But it takes us back even further to the very beginning of John, because from the very beginning, we've known that this gospel is about life. Not just biological life, respiration and reproduction, but a whole new kind of life, eternal life, the love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, fullness of God's life in us. Life in its best and widest sense. We saw with Lazarus that Jesus can't get any more clear about his stance on life. I am the resurrection and the life, he says. Whoever believes in me, though he die, yet shall he live. Everyone who lives and believes in me shall never die. In Jesus, as the God-man, the very life of God is melded with humanity. And Jesus has come in order that all of us might experience that same kind of life. Jesus says, I'm the very life of God, here and now, forever, for you. It's one thing to claim that kind of revolutionary life. But then he calls Lazarus out of the tomb, right? And he shows us in that he truly does wield authority over resurrection and life. And so he has this kind of absolute authority. He can just overturn death, and he can overturn everything that it represents. He's the shepherd that's come to cast out the thief, right? He has this absolute authority to impart to us the very life of God, to all who believe in him, giving us bread and water to sustain heavenly life. I mean, imagine being in Bethany that day, where one moment Jesus is just kind of standing around talking with his friends. He's weeping over death. And then just a blink later, he's overturning it. He's calling a man forth from the tomb. There's a kind of profound interruption of the status quo that happens when something like that happens, right? There's a demand for decision that happens with that kind of confrontation. And so just like always in the gospel, Jesus is the elephant in the room. he's something that's there and has to be dealt with. He acts in ways that demand interpretation. Either we believe that Jesus is the one sent by God, bearing the life of God, or we reject him. And of course, in this contrast between life and death, we know that rejecting Jesus is choosing death. So in Lazarus, Jesus has kind of presented this life and death ultimatum, hasn't he? You may have noticed that the raising of Lazarus is the final miracle in Jesus' public ministry until his own resurrection at the end of the gospel. And it makes sense, doesn't it, that this would be the peak of his public ministry. It's the most resonant with the final purpose that he's heading for, where he's going to die to defeat death, and he's going to rise to give life to the world. And right here, right in this kind of space where Jesus is making his most conclusive statement on life, it's right in that very place where his enemies are making their most conclusive statement on death. So you see that in verse 49. It says, one of them, Caiaphas, who was the high priest that year, said to them, you know nothing at all, nor do you understand it is better for you that one man should die for the people, not that the whole nation should perish. He did not say this of his own accord, but being high priest that year, he prophesied that Jesus would die for the nation. Not for the nation only, but also to gather into one the children of God who are scattered abroad. Let's look at Caiaphas' words a little more closely. It turns out that he's done something very shrewd politically here. The council is quibbling and quavering in fear over the crowds going after Jesus. And Caiaphas has come up with a solution. And it's a bit faded, isn't it? Because he's already rejected life, and so there's only one choice for him to make. He must embrace death. Jesus must die, he says. He must die in order to save our people. I've done the math. It's better that Jesus dies than everybody. Of course, the irony is very thick, isn't it? Caiaphas says, Jesus must die in order to save the people from him. Jesus says, I must die in order to save the people from themselves. But what's really ironic is the way that Caiaphas, with this kind of tongue of poison, is uttering an oracle of God. And so John says, the power of the office of high priest is at work here. This is an inadvertent prophecy by Caiaphas. What Caiaphas meant for death, God has ordained for life. Jesus must die for the people. And as John is quick to add, not only them, but for the life of the world, making a children out of everybody that's scattered abroad. But the outcome, the immediate outcome, is verse 53. So from that day, they made plans to put him to death. That word there, made plans, that's a procedural sense of the word. So if we were in our AGM, we would say they passed a resolution to put Jesus to death. John is very clear in his agreement with the other Gospels that Jesus' death is unjust, that it was decided before the trial, and that it was decided completely apart from evidence of his guilt. But here we kind of get the backroom deal. It's the leaders putting forward their Machiavellian plot to keep power by killing Jesus. What is so wonderful for us to see is the way that Jesus will overcome their abuse of that power. The way that by weakness and self-sacrifice and faithfulness to God, he overturns their entire plan of death. After all, what these leaders in their unbelief and death have ordained for Jesus is what God has ordained from eternity, that Jesus must die for the life of the world. And all of a sudden, we see how redemption is possible, where there's this collision of the very worst of humanity and the very best of humanity, with the leaders and Jesus colliding on the cross, where that act of unbelief raises Jesus up on the cross, and yet once he is lifted up, all the nations stream to him in faith. This act of death and putting Jesus to death will expend death's power forever. And Jesus will finally be victorious as the resurrection and the life. I think for us it's helpful to see the way that the leaders rationalize their choice. And perhaps we could recognize that rationalization in ourselves. The leaders here, they're choosing death, but they couch it in the language of life. There's a pretense of nobility here. Jesus dies for the sake of the people, along with the pretense that there's no other alternative, that expediency justifies itself. I've just finished reading a book on American slavery, and the thesis of the book is that the reason slavery lasted so long in the U.S., despite its obvious immorality and its brutality beyond any slavery that had preceded it, the reason it endured was because it was just too profitable to give up. But not only profitable for the slave owners in the South, it was profitable for the Northerners as well, because they had underwritten the entire thing with their capital. They were investors in it. And so nobody was willing to shake up the status quo. It's exactly what the religious leaders are doing, isn't it? Here we have Jesus, the life giver, becoming fodder for death. He's ground up in these kind of gears of expediency for the sake of the stability and progress of the Jewish people. But I wonder what ways we still struggle with that today. In what ways are we, so to speak, giving up others to death for the sake of expediency? Or because there's no other alternative? In other words, how do we choose death in our lives over the kind of life that Jesus is offering? Our third point is the contrast between wilderness and Jerusalem. The final verses of our text spell out the theme that's been going throughout John, which is this contrast between wilderness and Jerusalem, or you could say country and city. You could say the heresy and temple, Samaria and Galilee, or the place where the festivals happen. There's this kind of division that's really explicit in John. And so if you look down at verse 57, you'll see that that Jesus' death order is essentially already signed, and now there's an all-points bulletin out for his arrest. And with that being the background, Jesus retreats in verse 54. It says he no longer walked openly among the Jews. He went from there to the region near the wilderness, to a town called Ephraim, and there he stayed with his disciples. So Jesus leaves Jerusalem. He goes to the place where he is accepted, the outskirts, the boonies. Ephraim is about 15 miles from Jerusalem, but it's right on the edge of nothing. And Jesus stays there with his disciples. Now, there's an increasing sense as the Gospel of John ramps up that we'll see that all people reject Jesus. Even Peter denies Jesus. But there's also this ongoing contrast presented in John between the city of Jerusalem and what it represents, which is power and influence and religious orthodoxy, namely the Pharisees. There's a contrast with that and the wilderness and what it represents, which is irrelevance, obscurity, and religious heterodoxy. So you could think of the woman from Samaria. And the very simple point that is made in the Gospel of John over the entire Gospel is that Jesus is received by the weak and the obscure and the sinner, and rejected by the powerful, important, and righteous. Jesus knows that he will be rejected in Jerusalem. He knows that he will die there. And yet, he retreats for a time until the Passover is at hand, in verse 55. And as that call goes out to all Jews to make pilgrimage from wilderness to city for the Passover, there's only one question on everybody's lips. Will Jesus, friend of the Samaritan, enemy of the Sanhedrin, dare to go to the feast? We know, of course, that he does go, and he goes directly to his death. But he is seeming to wait in order that he might time it with the Passover. And so there's this interesting thing here where it says the Jews are streaming to the festival to purify themselves. And of course, we know the very purpose of Jesus going to his death in Jerusalem is to make purification. This call to come to the Passover is going out to all faithful Jews, but it's only answered by one faithful Jew, truly, as Jesus goes for the culmination of giving life to all who believe. But first and foremost, to the outcast, the weak, the humble, and even the heterodox, the people that believe the wrong things, the Samaritans and Gentiles. It's amazing, isn't it, how Jesus does this throughout the Gospel of John, how he takes the actions of unbelief, the actions of death, the actions of power in Jerusalem, and transforms them into the very place where belief and life are poured out for not just Jerusalem, but the entire world. And so the snapshot that we have here from the top of the bridge is a vantage point where we can see the whole purpose of God. Jesus has overcome the leaders and their culture of death, leading to death. He has overcome the powerful by their own power, the unbelieving by their own unbelief. And he's opened a door for us to enter, powerless and weak, yet accepted by God through faith in the man that brings life to the world. In the words of Ephesians that we read, right? For by grace we have been saved through faith, not of our own power, that no one may boast. I think this is the final thing for us to think about this morning from our passage. Whose resemblance do we bear? Do we bear the resemblance of the leaders in Jerusalem, powerful, proud, and expedient, utterly practical in our decisions? Or do we bear the resemblance of Jesus' wilderness disciples, weak, humble, manna-dependent, outcast, rejected? Amen.